Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy rants and raves from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber, your host. On today's show, spying on foreigners. Should our foreign surveillance practices be reformed? And in a world where data flows from country to country so seamlessly, is it even possible to only spy on foreigners and not also spy on your own citizens? And is our oversight of these programs sufficient? Joining me in our DC studio to discuss this is Nathan Lemer, a policy analyst at the R Street Institute. Nathan, thank you for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So when we talk about foreign surveillance these days, what we're really talking about is Section 702. And the original FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that was passed in 1978. But then after 9/11, it was reformed in 2008 to give the government more authority, the FISA Amendments Act. So Nathan, what is Section 702 and why are we talking about this?
Yeah, so Section 702 and Section 215 have been recently discussed a lot in terms of spying and surveillance questions. Section 215, which usually refers to domestic mass surveillance of telephone records, which we addressed in the USA Freedom Act this past year. But Section 702 is dealing with the mass surveillance and collection of data for foreign targets. Usually looking at people who we suspect outside of the U.S. are committing terrorism or involved in terrible acts, if you will, harming our country. But the problem is that a lot of these programs inadvertently or maybe even on purpose collect the data of innocent Americans, millions of innocent Americans. And it's not just our phone records. It's text messages. It's internet correspondence. It's our search records and browser histories and all that stuff.
Right. So when the Edward Snowden revelations first came to light, the biggest offender was the bulk collection of Americans' telephone records. This was just indiscriminate sweeping up of phone metadata. And as you mentioned, we reformed that program last year with the USA Freedom Act. However, that was hardly the end of the story. That only dealt with phone record collection, and it didn't deal with foreign surveillance, and it didn't deal with the emails and texts. So does the Section 702 program allow the government to search Americans' communications without a warrant?
Yes, it does. So Section 702 is usually used to access the data of information of foreigners. However, in this large sweeping of data, we have this warrantless access to our backdoor data. So backdoor access into our internet records and whatnot. And that's questionable about the legality. And that's really concerning, especially with American companies' competitiveness overseas and whether foreigners can trust our data or even Americans if we should be secure in our own information.
Yeah, if there's a perception that American tech products are tainted and that foreigners who use our products will not feel secure in their communications, then that could lead to competitive disadvantages for companies. That could lead to lost revenues and lost profits. Now, we saw with the USA Freedom Act and the Section 215 bulk collection of phone data program that sunsets are important. Putting expiration dates on these laws that were passed, you know, in a reaction to terrorism, when lawmakers are not necessarily thinking clearly and they're just trying to do something. And when Section 215 was about to expire, it created momentum for reform. Now, Section 702 does not expire until December of 2017, but what you've been arguing is that we need to start having this debate now, because if we don't have the debate now, we don't have a public and open debate, we're not going to get to where we need to go. Are we having an open and public debate about Section 702 and whether this is a good program, whether it effectively counters terrorism?
In short, we're just beginning the conversation. One of the best reasons we had any reform in the first place in Section 215 starts with the Edward Snowden revelations. It's clear that with 2 years out in 2013, that started the ongoing conversation. And then you had multiple bills introduced, and you had multiple amendments being brought to the floor and voted on. And you had a really large, dynamic conversation. But unlike with Section 702, with 215, it became a public debate because these records were legally or illegally brought to light. It forced members of Congress and the public to have an open dialogue. And we haven't had that with Section 702 yet, because a lot of this information is top secret, it's confidential. And so questions of efficacy, which we had in the Section 215 discussion, we had those in the open debate. Members of Congress could debate whether or not this program has actually caught a bad guy, which it hasn't. Whereas Section 702, there's a lot of good examples of this program being used to catch the bad guys, to thwart terrorism or other dangers. Unfortunately, though, we haven't had an open discussion about the right balance. And so you had with the Massey-Lofgren amendment and I forget who the other co-sponsor of that bill was. Poe-Lofgren amendment. You had this question about backdoor data. So that's one area of the Section 702, the backdoor upstream of our data. That is something that is interesting. And that's something we have had an open discussion about a little bit, but it's a small facet of a much larger conversation.
Yeah, and recently the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on Section 702, and privacy advocates were outraged, including your organization and mine, because it was a closed hearing. And not only was it a closed hearing, the only witnesses were from the FBI, the Department of Justice, the Director of National Intelligence, and the National Security Agency. So when you're trying to get both sides of a story or multiple sides of a story or to really dig into an issue and see what's going on, the only stakeholders you invited to the table are the people who never want to give an inch on surveillance reform. So how can we have an open public debate about foreign surveillance in a closed hearing where all of the witnesses are government officials and privacy advocates don't even get their say?
So the track record for congressional leaders is not great on open discussion. As we know, it wasn't until the Ron Wyden question of James Clapper about whether the phone records were being spied on. And I think James Clapper said, not unwittingly.
Yeah, this was the famous moment where James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, I believe, he just lied to Congress.
Yeah, basically just kind of lied. And we could catch him in a lie because of the Stone revelations.
Yeah.
But rarely have Congress had such an open dialogue on these issues, because it's usually in private, it's usually in the name of top secret national security. So the track record isn't good for Congress. And so whenever we see a hearing that's closed to the public, and therefore groups like us can't be involved, even just to listen or even to ask questions or to work with members of Congress, it's not just advocacy groups, it's also staffers, very limited access to staffers. Not every staffer that works on judiciary has top secret clearance. They don't have the right clearances to properly help their members address these issues and deliberate over these tough questions. The saving grace for this House Judiciary hearing was that it has been pitched to us, and this is my hope, is that it's the first of many conversations. And if you remember in last year's conversation on the USA Freedom Act, Chairman Goodlatte promised that he would have an open discussion about this in the future. And so my hope is that this was a kickoff, if you will, to kind of wet the whistle of these members, so they can get an idea of what's happening and what they're talking about, and then hopefully from there they can have a more open discussion where we know more what's going on.
And privacy advocates have sent letters, you know, about this many times. And one of the problems is that the House Select Committee on Intelligence, they have a lot of information, but average members of Congress do not. So what are some of the ways that staff are left out of the loop? And you've mentioned that members will complain to you and say, we didn't even know what was going on. How can we have an informed opinion about this foreign surveillance program if we are just denied access to information?
Yeah, National Journal wrote an incredible article earlier this year talking about the rooms in Congress, in the Capitol Hill, where members can go to read this secret information, and they're very limited in their access of what they can do. I believe you can sit in this closed room. It's not much bigger than the room we're in right now, and it has, you know, soundproof walls and all that stuff. And there's top secret guards outside, and it's like a James Bond episode. And you walk in, and the member has no staff with them. He or she can write notes, but then can't take those notes with them. They can't bring a staffer in to talk, and so the only people that have access are, you know, House Permanent Select Committee staffers who are basically not loyal to the member themselves, but loyal to the leadership who selected them and to the committee.
You're not going
to
bite the hand that feeds you. If you were given this special privilege to read this classified information, why would you ever rock the boat and give them a reason to kick you off the committee?
Right, exactly. So the members have that, and the staff have that. And so, you know, if you talk to, you know, I love having conversations conversations with Pat Eddington from Cato, who's worked as an intelligence committee staffer, and gives you kind of like unclassified horror stories of what information's out there. But it really speaks to this kind of corruption of basically how members, the bulk of members, the rank and file, are left in the dark, because if they want to know information, they have to play a game of 20 questions. So they get the data, they get this, you know, they get to read the documents, that's secret, and then they go into these hearings with the intelligence community staffers who are there to answer the questions, and they literally play 20 questions. They have to figure out how to word the question in a way that gets them, gets the intelligence community to answer properly, and then get you in details on there.
Right, they have little incentive to answer the questions. And one of the knocks against Edward Snowden was that he didn't go through the proper channels, right? There are people who quibble with what he did because of the methodology, not necessarily because they support indiscriminate surveillance. But people criticize him for not going through the proper channels. A lot of these letters argue there aren't proper channels because congressmen are not permitted to speak to whistleblowers without ramifications. So say what you want about Edward Snowden, but we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now if he didn't do what he did. So in addition to helping congressmen talk to whistleblowers, what are some of the reforms that R Street is pushing for to improve oversight of the Section 702 program?
So great question. So HPSI is the main...
That's the Select Committee on Intelligence.
They are the gatekeepers in Congress on what information is accessible to members of Congress and to the public. And one of the things that R Street is working on with groups like Demand Progress, and FreedomWorks, and CDT, and Third Way, and other groups are working together on HPSI modernization. And so we're working through the House rules efforts to change the way that we do HPSI policy. So modernizing the members that are on there. So instead of just being handpicked by leadership, it would be done in a way that represents all the different facets of Capitol Hill. So you have more liberty-leaning people and some more establishment-leaning people.
A more balanced dialogue.
Exactly. Then also, we're one of the main focuses that I have as a former staffer on the Hill, it's super interesting to me, is having more staff designees. So you have more staffers who work directly for their boss and are able to have access to this information, instead of the members just having staffers that are really honestly loyal to the Senate, which isn't the same case in the Senate. The Senate has a little different structure, and so that, but the House is where, you know, a lot of these deliberations are happening, and so we want to give the members the correct information that they need.
And you mentioned earlier, Section 702, unlike the Section 215 program, the bulk collection of phone data was never once showed to be useful, and that's why it ended, because when we had a 2-year-long discussion about the efficacy of the program, and the intelligence community could not convince a judge that it had led to anything, we got rid of the program. That might not be the case with Section 702. You know, there might, as you said, there have been instances where this program has helped intelligence agencies either thwart an attack or do other things to keep Americans safe. But what you're saying is we just need to have a discussion about the balance between national security and privacy. And if these members don't have that information, we can't have that discussion, and we'll never know if this program is as effective as they say. But there's a couple of different approaches. You know, with the expiration date coming up, some groups are calling for just complete removal of Section 702. Other groups are calling for reform. Where do you stand?
That's a great question. My heart is with the full repeal, but my head knows that we need to have a balanced discussion. And I think any efforts, and this is just me speaking, but any efforts to change the way Section 702 works needs to be in concert with members of Congress. And I think that the public needs to work with the members to know what the limits are and where the levels of support are. I know certain members, like Senator Rand Paul, might be interested in full repeal. He wants to end NSA tomorrow. God bless him. And I do too, in my heart. But I also know that how do you get 218 members of the Congress to do that? How do you pass 60 votes threshold in the Senate to do that.
Right.
And I think that we can learn lessons from Section 215, where USA Freedom Act, as introduced, was a very idealistic bill and a very good bill. And a lot of us had a lot of support in Tech Freedom in our street. We're among those people that supported it. And then it had changes, and it got whittled down. It got different input.
Of course.
But that's the way it's the nature of D.C., and I think that we need to have a conversation, a right balance of the revolutionary spirit that Bernie Sanders embodies nowadays, as well coupled with the rational Mike Lee approach to finding a good bill and a good solution. You mentioned in the conversation about members of Congress knowing about the efficacy and how efficient this is and how proper it is.
Yeah, is the program effective?
Right. You know, this conversation is happening in the law enforcement community and criminal justice on a totally similar bill, mandatory minimum reform and sentencing reform. Obviously, we have lower crime rates than we did 30 years ago. Was that because of the system as is now, or is our criminal justice system worthy of having taking a look at it and
right.
dialogue? And I think that same principle could apply to the NSA reform and Section 702 reform, because it's really about, yes, we have caught the bad guys, yes, the nation's been safe, no more 9/11s have happened, but we've had other questions about, could we do this more efficiently, more effectively? Could we do this in a way that doesn't affect the tech community and affect our economic output? Our street helped write a study 2 years ago that showed that there was like tens of billions of dollars lost in revenue, American revenue.
Yeah, it's not just an issue of constitutional rights and civil liberties. It's also a business problem. When you, like I said earlier, when there's a perception, and it warranted in many ways, a perception that American tech products are just tainted, that you can't trust these products because the NSA will collect your data without a warrant. That's what led to something we've talked about on the podcast, the death of the Safe Harbor Agreement. They've
right.
renegotiated it, but they haven't addressed the surveillance concerns that led to that Europe's highest court saying no more data transfers, or not no more data transfers, but we're now going to look at these a lot closer. So our street's leading an effort to reform at least the intelligence oversight aspect, and then maybe that will lead to reform of the program. What's next? How are the efforts going? The bill doesn't expire until 2017, but that doesn't mean nothing's going to happen. So what should listeners be looking out for?
So what listeners should be looking out for is a couple of things. First off, that every year we have the Worldwide Threat Assessment Hearing. And yesterday it happened, in which the top people from the FBI, the DOJ, NSA, the DNI came into the Senate and talked to the armed services and the intelligence community committees and said, basically, the world's going to end tomorrow unless you keep things going. Unless you keep, you know, mass surveillance happening and we break into encryption and not just keep 702, but strengthen it.
Right, fear-mongering.
Yeah, fear-mongering. Yeah. The problem is they've been doing this for like 25 years. and so I think that the listeners need to remember that there's a much more rational discussion. When you listen to the presidential debates, there's much more rational discussion than what you're hearing in the presidential debates. And also, there's an ongoing conversation on the Hill, twofold. First off, to modernize HPSI and modernize the way that the rank and file members have access to this information, so they're empowered to vote on bills and understand the consequences. There's also an issue, a couple pieces of language to draft what a better Section 702 would look like, what better reforms would look like. And
right.
I think over the next couple of years, we're going to be pushing judiciary, and they seem to be open to having this dialogue, to have more public hearings about this, to bring in members and staff so they understand the issues and open up the dialogue, not just to those committees, but to other people outside. We had this situation last month where it was revealed that Benjamin Netanyahu's correspondence with members of Congress concerning the Iran treaty were being spied upon by the NSA.
Yeah.
It's very concerning.
Kind of shocking. Yeah.
It's very concerning.
Foreign leader comes to the United States in good faith to have a conversation and he's being spied on.
In the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee is the one that has jurisdiction over that, to look at that. So that opens the committee jurisdiction so that more people can look at it. And a lot of privacy advocates are on that committee. So hopefully over the next couple months, there will be further review of that, and that won't just get lost in the news cycle, but we can actually have an ongoing discussion about that side of the Section 702.
Well, listeners will surely be looking out for that conversation. That's it for today's show. My guest has been Nathan Leamer, a policy analyst at the R Street Institute. Find out more about his work at rstreet.org. Nathan, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us at Tech Freedom on Twitter or on facebook.com/techfreedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will really help us out. Thank you for listening.